All right, so let's, as I said, let's go ahead and open to John chapter 18. It begins, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. And then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" All right, so we have just concluded Jesus' high priestly prayer in chapter 17. And then Jesus with his disciples, at the moment of his betrayal, tells us they enter the garden. And that's where we'll pick up. What I hope to do this morning is just quite simply do what really we're all supposed to do on a frequent basis and tell the story of Jesus' death. If you think about it, we do this as a church each week. We do it every Lord's Day when we take the Lord's Supper. Paul tells us when we do that, we're proclaiming his death, we're telling the story of his death, and this is perhaps the most important thing we have to do. That's the goal for today, is simply to tell the story of his death, and as we go through it, I think it's a worthwhile exercise for us to see this through the eyes of those who were there, to try to put ourselves in the midst of them and see it as John saw it. Because he was one of the primary witnesses of this event and of Jesus' death. I welcome your comments and thoughts. I will say this is an important story. It's important that we finish it. So if I do rush you along, please don't take offense. We're just trying to get through these chapters. But I do welcome any thoughts and comments you have. And as usual, there are slides. But I think the most important thing we have is what's on the page. So I encourage you, even though there's slides, let's focus on the page and not lose that. But we pick up in the garden with the arrest of Jesus. Jesus is going into the garden with his disciples, and Judas is there waiting for him. I remember this is in the night. This is late at night. Judas has come there specifically to betray Jesus. In fact, he's come there with armed men, seemingly aimed at violence and bloodshed. Jesus, it says in verse 4, knowing what would happen to him, he says he came forward and he said, "Whom do you seek?" When I read these words of Jesus, I think back to the moments in John when he first meets his disciples and his first words to them are, "What do you seek? What are you looking for?" Here, his last words to Judas are, "Who do you seek?" Knowing that Judas has come for him. So I think that's interesting. I think it's a connection we're meant to see. I think the setting of the garden is something we're meant to connect. When we finish these chapters, Jesus' body will be laid to rest in a garden tomb. So we're moving from one garden to another garden. If we think of the entire story of the Bible, we begin with a garden. And if you think back to Genesis chapter 3, at the fall of man, what you have there is God coming into the garden and looking for man. And in that story, it's day. God has come in the day. Man has hid himself from God. And man has tried to deceive God. And in this story, we have man, Judas, coming looking for God, only I think he doesn't realize he is looking for God, but we know he is, in fact, looking for God in the flesh in the night, and he's come armed and with evil intent, and Jesus is not hiding. Jesus is quite open, and Jesus is speaking the truth, and so I think that's a remarkable parallel as well. What we're told here, you have a scene that almost sounds like comic effect. It says, Jesus says, "Well, who do you seek?" And it says, they answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said to them, I am he. And Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with him. And when Jesus said to them again, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Only I don't think this is meant to be comedy. This is what happens when man comes to confront God. They literally cannot stand their ground. They fall to the ground. And I think that's a detail John, as someone who was there, wants us to know. It says in verse 7, he asked them again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he answered them and he said, I told you that I am he. And again, this is the same Jesus who made the I am statements. Again, now saying I am. This is the Jesus who says, I am the resurrection and the life. This is the Jesus who says, I am the bread of life. This is the Jesus who says, I am the true vine. But here he says, I am the one you're looking for. And then he says in verse 8, he says, so if you seek me, let these men go. This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken. Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. Jesus just prayed that in chapter 17. Those are direct quotes from his prayer. And I think what this shows us is Jesus is taking precautions for the safety of his disciples. It is very much his intent that nothing befall them on this night. And so he's taking care of their safety. He's protected his disciples. He specifically asked Judas and the armed men to let the others go, which we know happens. And then, of course, we're told here about an action that Peter takes. So in verse 10, it says, Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, and he cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. And so Jesus said to Peter, put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? And so we see here Jesus, one, taking actions to protect his disciples, and then he takes a further action even to protect Peter. He de-escalates the situation after Peter draws his sword and strikes out at the high priest's servant. From the other gospel accounts, we're not told who this is, but John identifies this as Peter. Some have found maybe some rivalry in here that John is pointing out Peter in particular. I think that's amusing. I don't think that's what's going on. I am quite confident John loved Peter, right? Why do we know this? Because John is Jesus's beloved disciple. Jesus commanded his disciples to love each other as he loved them. I'm confident John and Peter very much loved each other as brothers. I do think by identifying this as Peter, what John is doing in this telling of the gospel story is adding some critical information about Peter's denial that we're going to read about, and then even adding some information that I think helps us understand this intimate conversation we have with Jesus and Peter at the very end of the book. So I think John is very much giving us important information and important understanding maybe into Peter's mindset as he's about to betray Jesus. And then in verse 13, we see the first destination on his way to the cross. Jesus is taken to Annas' house, who we're told is a relation of Caiaphas. So we see that here in verse 13 and 14. It says, first they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. And then John wants us to remember back from John 11 that it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. So it was Caiaphas as the high priest that had made this unknowing prophecy about Jesus, that it would be his role to die for all the people. So as we move on to the house of Annas and his questioning by Annas and Caiaphas, the way John tells his gospel account, he's going to interweave Jesus' interrogation with Peter's denial. And so these things are happening simultaneously in this story. So we have here in verse 15, Peter and another unnamed disciple have followed Jesus. The rest of the disciples seemingly are no longer around. We will not see them at the cross either, but here we have John, we have Peter and an unnamed disciple. It says in verse 15, Peter followed Jesus and so did another disciple. And then it says that the other disciple had entered in with Jesus into the courtyard, and it said, but Peter stood outside at the door. In verse 17, there's a servant girl there, and she says to Peter, you also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? He said, I am not. And now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves, and Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. All right, so we have the first of Peter's denials. They ask him, weren't you also with this man? He says, I am not one of his disciples. So we get, like I said, John interweaves this story. Jesus, meanwhile, is being interrogated. He's answering truthfully and openly. Here we have Peter who, and perhaps he's motivated by fear. Remember, he's just struck one of the priest's servants with a sword. And so he, in fact, that's how he's going to be identified, because someone saw him do that. Peter, perhaps very much fearing for his own life, is now lying and denying that he is one of the disciples. So we have this contrast between Jesus, who is telling the truth while Peter lies. Jesus is speaking openly. Peter is hiding his identity. And then Jesus, we note in verse 22, is struck for his answers. So Jesus, in his interrogation in verse 20, he says, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard me what I said to them, for they know what I said. And when he said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is this how you answer the high priest? And then Jesus answered him and said, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me? And then they sent him to Caiaphas, the high priest. All right, so this is the beginning of the violence and the violent actions taken against Jesus. He is struck here in the middle of his interrogation as he's answering openly and honestly. John lets us know that this takes place, that Peter's denial takes place around a charcoal fire. I think that's interesting. Fires smell different. Like, fires have a very distinctive smell. You can remember the smell of a fire. When you smell it, you know it, even if you don't see the fire yet. And charcoal fires and wood fires, I think, even smell differently. But Peter's telling us, or John's telling us, this denial takes place around a charcoal fire. And then we see at the end of the book, when Jesus has his next conversation with Peter, that also takes place around a charcoal fire. And so you can imagine just the memory smell of that. The memories that must have brought back to Peter from a few days prior of his denial. John doesn't tell us, like the other gospel accounts do, that after his last denial that Peter ran out and wept bitterly, but we know that that's the case. And I think John is using this fire to make this connection, to bring back this sorrow and grief he must have felt about what he'd done when we get to the end of the book here and Jesus has his last conversation with Peter. So I think the detail of the fire is interesting. That's a detail that also could only come from someone who was there, who was an eyewitness like John and Peter. The denial. I want you to get a sense of how close Peter and Jesus are in proximity to each other when this happens. In Luke's account of this denial, it says, and as soon as Peter denied him the third time, that the rooster crowed, and it says that Jesus looked over at Peter. They were within eyesight of each other when these were happening. And if they're in eyesight of each other, they're very much perhaps in earshot of each other too. So it very much may be the case that Jesus, in fact, hears each of these denials as Peter is denying even knowing Jesus. And so I think that that's also important for us to understand. This is part of what's going on. This is part of what Jesus is enduring. His closest confidant is denying that he knows him while he's being unfairly put on trial and being leveled with unfair accusations. We're told in other places some of the things they're accusing him of is claiming that he would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. But here we have Jesus saying, I've only spoken openly. You know, ask anyone who has heard. Before we move on to Pilate, does anybody have any thoughts or comments? Okay, so we will we'll continue on. So in verse 27, we see the final denial. Beginning in verse 26, it says, one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter again denied it, and at once the rooster crowed. Verse 28 begins with, and then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning now, and they themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. All right, so here we're introduced to Pilate. Jesus is taken to Pilate early in the morning, and he has this somewhat private conversation with Pilate because the Jewish priests don't enter the governor's quarters, it tells us. And so in verse 33, it said, Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus to him and said, are you king of the Jews? Jesus answered, do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? And Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done? And Jesus answered and said, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. Then Pilate said to him, so you are a king. And Jesus answered and said, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. And Pilate said to him, what is truth? All right, so that's the encounter that Jesus and Pilate have. The Jews bring him to Pilate, and Pilate's initial reaction is, well, you do something with him. This doesn't sound like a matter for me. He says in verse 31, he said, take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. But the Jews said, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death. This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So Jesus, throughout this book of John, has been prophesying. He's been telling his disciples and others that he would be lifted up. And John has been telling us that when he says he would be lifted up, he's been doing this to communicate the kind of death he would die. That's a Roman execution. That's a crucifixion. The Jews, in fact, had, we well know from the Old Testament, there are death penalties prescribed, and even things for blasphemy, but it's stoning. They don't hang people on the cross. But it was God's plan. It was God's design that Jesus be hung on the cross. And so I think what John wants us to see is that this is God's plan in action, that he's being handed over to the Romans, that the Jews, in fact, aren't able to handle this under their own laws. They're not taking this into their own hands, whether that's out of fear or whatever motivation they have for wanting to take him to the Romans, to Pilate. I don't know. We know they had tried to stone him before. It had not worked. But John wants us to see that this is God's plan in action. That he was handed over to Pilate. Pilate's motivations have been talked about a lot. I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time talking about Pilate and his motivations. I'll just say that I think my impression of Pilate is he's motivated by two things. One, keeping the peace and sort of staying under the radar so he keeps his nose clean and stays out of trouble with Rome. And two, I think we get a picture of Pilate as somebody who very much would like to kind of make things inconvenient for the Jewish high priests and rulers when he gets a chance. He is someone who takes a little delight in being contrary to them, but at the same time, he very much wants to keep the peace, be a good governor, stay in good graces, above all with Rome. So Pilate is now questioning him about, are you king of the Jews? Because that is the charge that they have laid before Pilate, basically identifying Jesus as an insurrectionist, someone perhaps a threat to Caesar. And they have this conversation where Pilate doesn't seem very convinced that Jesus is much of a king. So Jesus is not going to look at all like anyone who Pilate would recognize as a king. Pilate has one king, and that's Caesar. And I think he sees someone that doesn't look anything like that in Jesus. But Jesus makes a statement that I find interesting. He says, "For if my kingdom was of this world, my servants would have been fighting." I think that Jesus is saying it's evident how devoted my disciples are. People have seen, people know the level of devotion of my disciples. And if this really was a worldly kingdom, they would be fighting, and you know that they would be fighting. And I think that's the point he's trying to make, is his disciples are devoted. And that's the very fact that his disciples are not taking up arms is the evidence that this is not a kingdom like others in the world. I think the proper interpretation of what he's saying his kingdom is not from the world. The source of his power and his reign and authority in this kingdom does not come from the world. It comes, obviously, from the very throne of God and from heaven. But it is a kingdom that is in the world. You know, he's going to establish his church in the world. It is for the world, not from the world, though. And Jesus is making the distinction between his kingdom and other kingdoms. But nevertheless, I think his disciples are just as devoted as you would expect if it was a kingdom from this world. Pilate says, "Well, what is truth?" John has already clued us in to what the great truth here in this passage is. It's the truth that Caiaphas prophesied about. It's that one man would die for the sake of the nation. And so that's the truth we see here at the end of verse 18. It says, "After Pilate had said, 'What is this? What is truth?' he went back outside to the Jews and he told them, 'I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release a king of the Jews?' And they cried out again and said, 'Not this man, but Barabbas.'" Now, Barabbas was a robber. All right, so Pilate says, "We have a custom. One man can be spared, and would you like me to spare this? You're king of the Jews, and this man." And of course, they shout no. And so now Jesus, his life has been given so that Barabbas can go free. And so we're already seeing this plan in action that one man will die to save others. Barabbas here is saved from his own execution or his own punishment. And Jesus will go to the cross as the crowd shouts, "Not this man, but Barabbas." So then verse 19 begins Jesus, or it continues Jesus' ordeal. So now that the crowds have refused to release Jesus, it says, "Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. And they came up to him saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they struck him with their hands." All right, so it says here they flogged him. And the Greek words here, he's being whipped. He's being whipped with the strands of leather that have things like bone and rock attached, things designed to tear the skin and to inflict great harm on the body. So Jesus, it says, is flogged. And then we have Roman soldiers mocking the idea that he's a king. They've taken his clothes, they put a crown of thorns on him, and they put him in a purple robe. And then we're told they mock him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they strike him with their hands. So here we see the soldiers stripping Jesus. I think we should think back to just the night before this. Jesus disrobes himself and puts on the clothes of a servant to love and care for his disciples. Here, he's loving and caring for his disciples in a far more painful way. Pilate is going to bring him out in verse here Pilate brings him out and he says, "Behold the man." This is in verse 5. It says, "So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, 'Behold the man.'" I think this sounds grand and glorious, but Pilate's intent here almost certainly was mocking. Some of the commentaries have pointed out other ways to translate this might even be like, "Look at this man," or "Look at this guy." "Look at how pitiful he looks," I think is the point Pilate's trying to make. He's inviting them to look at this man that they've called a king. But John, when he wrote his gospel, also invites us to look at this man. He said, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." It's this same word here, the eternal Word, the Word who was God and was with God, that they are now beholding, beaten, flogged, crown of thorns, purple robe, meant to be humiliated. This is the eternal Word who they were looking at. And then the chief priests cry out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Hang him on the cross is the literal translation of what they're shouting out here. They are asking for him to be hung up, lifted up on the cross, nailed to the cross. Remember that the Roman form of crucifixion would nail stakes through the wrists. He would be lifted up on a very high cross. This is what they're shouting for. This is their king, this is their Messiah, and they are shouting out, "Crucify him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Take him for yourselves and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." And the Jews answered him and said, "We have a law, and according to that law he ought to die, because he has made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered the headquarters again, and he said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" And Jesus answered him and said, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. And therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." All right, so here, after this, after they shout to crucify him, and they say again that he should die because he's made himself out to be the Son of God, Pilate again brings him back in and asks him who he is. And Pilate wants to remind Jesus that, "Don't you know I have the authority to release you, and I have the authority to crucify you?" Jesus' only response to that, he doesn't tell him, "No, you don't have this authority." He simply reminds Pilate where this authority comes from. He says, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above." So Jesus reminds Pilate who the ultimate source of authority in the world is. But he doesn't deny that Pilate has some authority here. So Pilate, still seemingly unsure, kind of waffling about what to do, it says, "From then on," verse 12, "Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, 'If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar.'" All right, so here we have, again, I think Pilate's primary motivation and what the Jews are now using to make sure Jesus goes to the cross. They remind Pilate that we're charging him with the crime of making himself out to be a king. In your language, Pilate, or in your law, this is insurrection. This is treason. And if you don't send him to the cross for this, what would Caesar think? That's the idea they want him to get. So then Pilate seemingly backed into a corner by his own motivations here. It says, when Pilate heard these words in verse 13, he brought Jesus out and he sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. And now it was the day of the preparation of the Passover, and it was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. And they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him, literally hang him on the cross. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priest answered, we have no king but Caesar. So he delivered him over to be crucified. Think about what a betrayal that is of God and what a betrayal that is of Jesus. These are the chief priests and rulers of Israel. Israel, who's supposed to be Israel's king? God. Israel has no king but God himself. And yet here is Israel, the very Israel who wants nothing more than to depose the Romans and have self-rule. Here they are chanting, we have no king but Caesar. I don't know. I think to me, that is a massive betrayal and said right in front of the Son of God. And I don't think we should miss the implications of that. Yeah, Josh?
Yeah, Brad, I find this whole scene to be fascinating because the Luke portrayal makes the statement that they were urgent, their voices were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So that tells us there were other voices. There were probably the voices of those who were laying down their garments and those that had found the palm leaves to welcome him into the city during the only a few days prior. So I find that fascinating that there were a group probably of supporters, but they were drowned out in this scenario. And it's amazing that if you want to teach your children about peer pressure, I think this story would be a great one to look to and say, well, how many of these people were supporters perhaps only days prior, and then from influence, from peer pressure, they gave way and supported Barabbas being released, which would never have happened in a normal scenario.
Absolutely. That's a great comment. And as John tells us here, it is primarily the chief priest who were shouting out, we have no king but Caesar. I think even adding more gravity to the betrayal that's taking place right here. And then Jesus' crucifixion begins with verse 17. It says, he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. It says quite simply in John's account, there they crucified him. So they hung him on the stakes. They hung him on the cross. Him with two others, one on either side, and Jesus in between them. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. And so the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather this man said, I am King of the Jews. And Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. And when the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his garments and divided them into four parts, one for each other, and also his tunic. But the tunic was seamless, woven into one piece from the top to the bottom. And so they said to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it, to see whose it shall be. This was to fulfill the scripture which says, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. All right, so Jesus is crucified, and I think we're not to miss that he is crucified in a very, very public place. Golgotha, we are told, is along a major road into Jerusalem. So this is a place many people would be passing by regularly and throughout the day. Jesus is crucified here in this very public place. That's why it said many of the Jews read the inscription. The inscription above him said, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. It was written in all the major languages of the world. Here I just, it seems like there's so much symbolism here. Here we have written on the cross this definitive statement, Jesus is the King of the Jews. He is Israel's Messiah, and it's announced to all the world in every major language that everyone can read. And of course, the chief priests don't like this. They want to go back and say, make it say, he said I am. But no, what Pilate has written, he's written, and it's the will of God that it says this, that Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. I think we're meant to see by the fact that this is written in all languages, this is an announcement to the whole world. This is an acknowledgement that the Messiah that was prophesied about in the Old Testament, his reign was supposed to be worldwide. Psalm 72, the Messianic Psalm, tells us it's from the sea to the sea to the ends of the earth. The Messiah, when he comes, would be a king for all the earth. Jesus said himself, I will draw all peoples to myself when I'm lifted up. Jesus is looking forward to this moment when he's on the cross and he draws all people to himself. And here the message of who he is written in all languages so that all will know. Jesus suffers a great indignity here. I think we don't often recognize, I think we pay attention to the prophecy here. But think about the fact that Jesus has been stripped. He's been hung on the cross. He's in agony. He's in pain. And he's watching men gamble over his clothes. I think this again is something that Jesus is enduring and that he's suffering. But this happens according to prophecy as well. So we know from Psalm 22, and that's the verse that's quoted here. It said, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. We're told in just six brief verses about the death of Jesus. We should read those. It says, but standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. All right, so we've got three Marys and his mother's sister are here at the cross. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved, so the disciple who Jesus loved is also at the cross. This we know is John. Jesus says to his mother, woman, behold your son. And then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour on, the disciple took her into his own home. So we see John records three things from Jesus in the last his last moments leading up to his death. Jesus provides for his mother. He looks to John and he looks to his mother. And he gives his mother to John, the disciple who he loves. In verse 28 and 29, we're told simply, it says, after this, Jesus, knowing that all was now finished, said to fulfill the scripture, I thirst. And a jar full of sour wine was stored there, and so they put a sponge full of the sour wine on the hyssop branch and held it to his mouth. And when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And he bowed his head up and he gave his spirit. This statement of I thirst, I think, is certainly something that stuck out to John and his memory of this event. It's significant. I think it demonstrates the very human agony of what Jesus is going through. This is the same Jesus, the same Son of God, who turned water to wine in chapter 2. And at that wedding feast, it wasn't just any wine, it was the best wine. And now when he thirsts, he's given the worst that there is to drink. The same Jesus who said he comes offering living water when he talks to the Samaritan woman at the well, he's now thirsty. And he's in his dying moments and he thirsts. The same who promised his disciples, those of you who believe in me shall never thirst, now he is thirsty. The same Jesus who prophesied and who proclaimed about the coming of the Holy Spirit that out of his heart will flow rivers of living water, now he is thirsting. And then it says he gives up his spirit, and he makes this great cry at the end here in verse 30. He says, "It is finished." All of the work that God has given to Jesus to do, he is now finished. And so his final words before his death here in John are recorded as, "It is finished." And then John gives us a very important witness here at the end of the chapter. Pilate orders at the end of the day the legs to be broken and the bodies to be taken down from the cross. This is because of what day it was. It was the day of preparation, and they couldn't be taken down on the Sabbath on the next day. And so in order to take the bodies down, Pilate needs to ensure, in fact, that the crucified victims are dead. And so he orders that the legs be broken. But we find here that, in fact, Jesus' legs are not broken. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who had been crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once came out blood and water. He who saw it has borne witness. His testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, that you also may believe. All right, so John himself observes two important things. He observes that Jesus' bones were not broken. John, from the very beginning of this gospel, John the Baptist identifies Jesus as the Lamb of God. He is the Passover Lamb. And we know from the Old Testament laws, they're very specific. The Passover Lamb's bones are not to be broken. And here it is John the disciple who observes this fact. Exodus 12:46 about the Passover Lamb says, "You must not break a bone of it." And here, Jesus' bones are not broken. And John is the witness to this. His side is pierced. It says blood and water comes forth. John himself is the eyewitness to this. This should call us back to Zechariah chapter 12, which talks about a side being pierced. Zechariah 12 verse 10 says, "I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me, on him whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only child and weeps bitterly over him." A few verses below that, 13:1 in Zechariah, it says, "On that day there shall be a fountain open for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and uncleanness." Zechariah prophesied about a fountain that would open up to cleanse from sin and uncleanness. And here John observes the piercing and the water flowing forth, the blood and water, the very blood that cleanses us from sin. And then real quick, and we'll come back to this just briefly next week, the burial of Jesus. We have Joseph of Arimathea who comes to take the body. We have Nicodemus who comes along with them. Nicodemus first came by night because he was afraid. But now Nicodemus, who has nothing to gain at Jesus' death, perhaps everything to lose, he might be identified with him, be cast out of the Sanhedrin. Now Nicodemus comes, and he comes to bury Jesus. He brings a lot of the ointment and the myrrh and the aloes. It says 75 to 100 pounds. This is 75 to 100 times as much as what Mary used when she anointed his feet. And so it's a great amount, an amount fit for a king, perhaps. And then Jesus is laid in a never-used tomb in the garden. And we'll pick up there next.